0-2 pitch. Swing and a miss. Knocked him out. The Philadelphia Phillies are 2008 World Champions of Baseball. It's Wednesday, August 31st, 2016. Welcome to the Philly Press Box Radio Roundtable, brought to you by ShopForKisses.org, the online shopping network of the Kisses for Kyle Foundation. I'm Bill Furman. I'll be your host tonight, along with my partner, Jim Chet Chesko. And Chet, so much for taking a week off. We should have known better. There's just too much to talk about with the Soul winning the Arena League Championship, the Phillies trading the very popular Carlos Ruiz to the Dodgers, a nice showing by the Eagles' first unit against the Indianapolis Colts. Now, what about John Dorenbos last night? Or should we say Heidi Klum on America's Got Talent?
Hey, the heck with Chooch, the Eagles, and the Soul. Let's talk about Heidi Klum's form as a long snapper. Now, but seriously, plenty of things that we need to discuss on what is episode number 99 of Philly Press Box Radio Roundtable.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that, it seems like we just started when we first got this thing going, and here we are, get ready to approach number 100.
Yeah, we've had some fun.
Yeah. Well, hey, before we get started, we want to let our listeners know that we will not have our Carl's Cards and Collectibles trivia question tonight, but we will have Carl himself, Carl Henderson, joining us instead.
Yeah, a special show, so we're getting a very special guy to join us. Should be a fun time.
Yeah, and then hopefully we get him because he's a busy man. And do you have him as on the line yet?
Not as of yet. So while we wait for Carl, you mentioned John Dorenbos. How do you enjoy his latest magic?
Well, you know, Chet, he is beyond what I can even comprehend. You know, the last one he did, I couldn't figure out. You know, like we said before, I think you see some magic and you think, okay, I get it. You know, but then you look at the stuff that he's pulling off and you think, how in the world is he doing that?
Yeah, he's pretty impressive. So I wish him well. I don't know what the votes are as yet for those semifinals, but I got to think he's going to be in the top five.
Oh, I think he is too. And I think he's got a real, real good chance of winning the thing. But I guess the thing I wonder is, you know, how do you keep raising the bar? How do you keep being better each show? Because he is, you know. And some of those acts last night, you could see where the judges thought, you know what, they didn't reach the level they had been at before, some of the other contestants. And, you know, they told them so.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens. And another thing we can talk about, the Philadelphia Soul, as you mentioned, winning Arena Bowl 29. I don't know if you got to see any of the game. I know you were busy that night. But I'll tell you, they were pretty impressive. They were underdogs. They were playing out in Arizona territory, and they pulled it off. They held them off. The Rattlers came back and tied it up, and then the Soul did win it in the end. So congrats to Ron Jaworski and company.
Yeah, I actually I didn't see it live, and as you know, you were texting me some updates. I was doing broadcasting the high school game, but I did tape it. I did watch it, and you know, maybe because it was the championship, and maybe because it was the Soul, it was actually fun to watch.
Yeah, it really was, and that is their second championship, and they got a little revenge because they were there twice before against the Rattlers, only to come up a little bit short. So nice to see, and it was fun. And then one of their guys, a defensive lineman, ended up getting signed by the Eagles this week. So congrats to him. Metz, I believe his name is.
Yeah, and he is a Shippensburg guy as well, I believe.
Yeah, yes, he is. Yes, he is. So congrats to him and to Ron Jaworski. And we have Carl Henderson joining us on the line.
All right. And then, hey, Chet, I did want to say one more thing on the Soul. I mentioned to you last week about Chris Duvault being part of that team, and Chris was the kick returner and wide receiver, and we're going to line Chris up and get him on a future show with us.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Well, hey, Mr. Carl Henderson, the Big C, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thanks for having me.
Always
good
our
to have
pleasure.
You, Carl.
Hey, we wanted to one of the most important things we want to talk about is the trading of Chooch, Carlos Ruiz. I know you you've been associated with him and his people for many, many years, and was just want to get your opinion on that whole deal and how you think it went out went down and how it's looking for him.
Well, he appears to be playing quite a bit. I was watching a little bit of the game this afternoon, and there he was catching again. So I guess the Dodgers, you know, planned on bringing him in to use him for that left-handed. Good for him. Personally, I was sorry to see him go, but, you know, time has come. But Chooch was always, you know, always a favorite around here.
Hey, Carl, you probably heard on last week's show, Bill and I talked about the Phil's four long-term catchers over the last 40 years, Boone, Dalton, Lieberthal, and Carlos Ruiz, going over the merits of all four. Bill put a gun to my head, and I had to make a choice, and I ended up going with Dalton as the guy I would take in starting a team. But I'm guessing you'd go with Chooch, am I right?
Yes, with Dalton right behind him. I mean, it was close. I probably only gave Chooch the nod because of my – you know, my personal relationship, although I've worked with Dalton quite a bit as well. They're the top two for sure.
What?
You mentioned working with Chooch. Tell me a little bit about him as a guy, because, you know, we don't see a whole lot of him as far as his personality, because maybe some of the language barrier. He doesn't get interviewed all that much, just maybe once in a while after the game. But, you know, tell me your relationship with Chooch and what you can, you know, tell our listeners about Carlos Ruiz, the person.
Well, from the beginning, the very first appearance was very difficult because there was a lot of sign language going on. You know, my Spanish isn't very good, and, you know, his English was not good either. So we had a real problem, and he did have a translator, a friend of his that he brought along, who he still is by his side to this day. So, you know, we got through it, and I think over time he got better, but it was still, still difficult at times. I know I see a lot of the interviews, and, you know, you really have to pay attention to what he's saying to figure some of it out. But he was always just so gracious and, you know, just a gentleman. I mean, he never – you know, he was great with the kids. He was, you know, a gentleman with the ladies. He was just, he was all that. I mean, everything you've read about him is 110% true.
Well, hey, Big C, do we have to have a little further debate about Ruiz and Dalton clearly being number one and number two? I believe I did not pick either one of them.
And you've known to be wrong in the past, so, you know, we'll go with that mulligan.
Greg, you might want to point that other one time out.
Well, I mean, you know, I would need a whole show for that. But I know you're a big Bob Boone fan, and so am I. I mean, I lived the 80 Phillies. I was there. You know what I mean? But I just think, you know, I mean, Dalton was there on those horrible years. You know what I mean? And then bang, you know, 93. You know, that whole that whole fun team, you know, that was great, you know, but we got to, you know, you got to factor in those 5 years, you know, what was it? 07 to 11, you know, those were five phenomenal years.
Well, maybe they weren't playing baseball from 76 to 81. When maybe I missed that part of my life.
Yeah. They were good years too.
You know, did you bring me on to debate, Bob Boone? Come on.
Sure, why not?
My listeners don't want to hear that.
All right, well, we'll let you off the hook. But, hey, I do want to ask you, what about the Eagles now? We got a good preseason game out of them the other night. Again, it's preseason. You know, you guys all know how I feel about that, but are we feeling optimistic, Big C? And what do your people come in your store thinking? Are they skeptical or are they optimistic?
Well, so far it's been a lot of talk about the defense. And I've got a friend that lives down there in Florida that's a big defensive guy. You know, defense wins championships. So
he's right.
So, you know, I mean, there we go. If that's the beginning, we got that covered.
Carl, let me ask you what you've seen from this Eagles squad. I mean, are you on board with Sam Bradford? We have the wide receivers who nobody's real high on. Can this team score enough points to win games?
I don't think so. I don't think there's a running game there, and I don't think there's a passing game there. I think Sam would be okay if he had some receivers to throw the ball and catch the ball. You know, Jordan Matthews, you know, I mean, on any other team, he's probably, what, a second, you know, the second receiver. There's a lot of missing parts on that offense.
But I'll say this. If preseason week number three were the Super Bowl, the Eagles would be back-to-back champions.
Okay, I'll give you that.
Who do we have, Chet, back? Back in the springtime, we had one of our guests, I forget who it was, said that the Eagles won whatever month it was, May. They were the May champions, and now they're going to be the August champions.
Yeah, it was Kevin Cooney.
Maybe we can be there in January.
Nobody does March like the Eagles, said Kevin Cooney, and he's right about that. They had a lot of moves the last two springs, and they did well, we thought, at the time, but it didn't carry over into the season last year. We'll see how it works out this year.
Yeah, Carl, we were talking briefly before you came on about the Soul and winning the championship. Any interest in that coming through the store, or is that such a sideline sport that you don't get much talk about it in there?
Yeah, there's not a whole lot. Jaws really pumps it up, and you know the city should be thankful they have Jaws to do that. You know, being a great owner, you know, it's just, you know, it's to me it's a secondary sport. You know, they didn't even get a parade. How pathetic is that? You know, I just thought, geez, you know, come on, give them a parade. Why not? But no, there's not a whole lot going on there, and I'll be quite honest with you. I did turn them on the other night, and I got a little nervous because I thought they were going to give it back to them late in the game.
Yep, me too. Hey, Carl, I got one other question for you, one other topic while we have a moment before we get to your signings update. Today, of course, is the 20th anniversary of the Wells Fargo Center, although it's had three previous names. I know you've been there countless times, so I was thinking about it, but let me ask you, what are some of your top visits to the Wells Fargo Center, your top memories?
I'll tell you, I was thinking about that today because of the whole 50th anniversary and the Flyers just introduced a new jersey, and,
yep.
You know, I was trying to go back, and there's been quite a few. I mean, I just, 2000, I, what was it, 10, you know, the Flyers were in the finals, and, I mean, there's been a lot of great, you know, great runs there at the Wells Fargo. I mean, you know, the opening of the building with Lindros, you know, right on up to the current day with Hextall taking back over. And I'm a big music guy. I mean, probably not as big as you, Chet, but you know, I've been to many concerts there. I enjoy the building so much. But I think when people think of Philly sports and the Flyers and that type of history, they're going to go right back to the Spectrum because that's where, you know, that's where it all got done.
Hey, let me give you my top three real quick. I haven't seen a whole lot of memorable games there. I mean, I've seen some hockey and basketball, but nothing spectacular, to be honest. So my top three are all concerts. That'll be number three, Trans-Siberian Orchestra in 2006 when they brought out John Anderson for an encore, and he did Roundabout. Number two would be Roger Waters doing The Wall in 2010, spectacular. And number one, the 50th anniversary show of the Rolling Stones in 2013, just because they're the Stones and they're still great.
And I was there for two out of the three, and I couldn't agree with you more. Yeah, I was.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I have to tell you, I have a list of one. Of course, I haven't been able to get down there near as much as you guys, but my list of one is the last game of the season, I believe in 2010, when the Flyers beat the Rangers in a shootout to make the playoffs.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
That's a very good one.
All right, yeah. Carl, before we run out of time, can you give us a quick update on your signings? I know you got some good stuff going on.
Yeah, appreciate that. Thank you. Saturday, September 10th, we've got Eagles legend Harold Carmichael. He's been in the store in the past, and, you know, he's just a fan favorite. So we got him coming back on September 10th from 1 to 3. And then we've got a new guy, Hall of Famer Dave Robinson, a Penn State guy, a Packer guy, a Redskin guy. So, you know, we're really looking forward to working with him. Went in the Hall of Fame 2013. So we've got a lot of interest in people collect Hall of Famers. So that'll be a good one on Saturday, September 17th from 1 to 3. The following week, we've got a new Eagle, Rodney McLeod, who, you know, his agent contacted me last year, and we worked out Eric Rowe. So I'm hoping that Rodney might be a little bit better than Eric Rowe. No sarcasm there or anything. Hope it works out a little better. September 24th, and then the big one is October 8th with the Golden Jet Bobby Hall, Hall of Famer Bobby Hall, on October the 8th. So
awesome.
Really looking forward to that one.
Fantastic. And I can tell you, I've had an opportunity to meet and talk with Dave Robinson kind of at length about his playing days with Coach Lombardi, and he is just a super, super good guy.
Yeah, I'm really I love the stories. You know, a lot of these guys are very passionate, and, you know, I love the stories. So, yeah, that's one I'm really looking forward to. But I love the old guys because they bring a lot of history with them.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Carl. Well, we appreciate you joining us on short notice. We appreciate you taking the time. And I think if you listen in, the rest of the show, you're probably going to enjoy what we got in store here.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me. And go Birds.
Go Birds.
All right, Carl. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks, Chet.
Okay, Chet, let's thank our sponsor, ShopForKisses.org, the online shopping network of the Kisses for Kyle Foundation. By logging on to www.shopforkisses.org's website, you become connected to over 3,000 stores, including the big ones you already shop at. Every purchase made gets you cash back, and each purchase benefits the Kisses for Kyle Foundation, which helps families dealing with childhood cancer throughout the Delaware Valley. If you have any questions, contact Bob Sullivan at bobsullivan.shopcom@gmail.com or give him a call at 484-319-8043. And, Chet, hey, I know you have a surprise for us all, and including me tonight. So I, like the rest of the listeners, will get to hear this for the very first time. Tell us about it before we roll it.
All right, in brief, next week, show number 100. So in advance of that, I decided to put together a little retrospective of shows 1 through 98. I looked back at the many awesome guests we somehow managed to get to join us. I put my thinking cap on to try to recall some of the best or most fun moments. Then I got to work grabbing a bunch of audio bites, writing a script, and I came up with what I think is a pretty entertaining look back at some of the highlights of doing this little internet radio show since the spring of 2014 until now. So you ready?
Let's go for it. Can't wait to hear about it. We'll talk about it here when we're through.
The 0-2 pitch. Swing and a miss. Knocked him out. The Philadelphia Phillies are 2008 World Champions of Baseball.
If you're a regular listener, you know those classic sound bites are what we've used to open just about all of the first 98 episodes of the Philly Press Box Radio Roundtable. I'm Jim Chesko, Chet to most, and my radio partner Bill Furman and I have somehow made it to show number 99. So before our special 100th episode on September 7th, we thought this would be a great time to look back at how we got here.
Woo-hoo!
both longtime Philadelphia sports fans, Bill and I met in 2013 when we were each writing occasional articles and doing some sports talk radio for TalkSportsPhilly.com before deciding the following spring to launch our own show. We did our inaugural show on April 30th, 2014, taking some time at the top of the program to tell folks a little about ourselves in relation to the Philly sports scene.
Please allow me to introduce myself.
I went first.
I'm old enough to have seen Wilt play as a 76er, Dick Allen as a Philly, Timmy Brown as an Eagle, but still young enough, I hope, to realistically believe that maybe, just maybe, I'll witness an Eagles Super Bowl victory. So, yeah, despite having been alive for more than 4,000 of the Phillies' 10,000-plus losses, the Eagles' ongoing quest for that first-ever Super Bowl win, a lot of futility for the 76ers, and the Flyers' inability to get that third Stanley Cup, I remain a diehard fan who still loves to watch all of those teams and talk about them with other frustrated fans like you. So let's do it, and let's have some fun with it.
I've seen a lot. I used to go to Franklin Field. Back in the early days, I was actually there when they threw snowballs at Santa Claus. Was there when they flew the helicopter over Franklin Field with the Joe Must Go banner with Joe Kuharik back in the day. So seeing a whole lot of it, and of course with the Flyers from day one, been a fan all along and have enjoyed that. And also got to see Wilt play myself. My first job ever was as an usher at the fabulous Palestra.
Go! Our very first guest was sports junkie Kevin McClure. Other interesting early guests included author and humorist Matt Goldberg and a guy named Joe Ferry from the Dick Allen Belongs in the Hall of Fame campaign, something that Bill and I agree should happen, by the way. Before long, we snagged lots of other terrific guests, including several members of the Philadelphia area media, like Calkins Media's Tom Moore and Kevin Cooney, the Daily News' Mike Kern, the Inquirer's Frank Fitzpatrick and Mike Sielski, and NJ.com's Elliot Shore Parks and Mark Eckel, although it would sometimes take a little arm twisting.
I'm only here because you promised me beer.
Yeah, sometimes deals need to be struck. But Mark Eckel has actually been our most frequent guest, joining us 6 or 7 times since we started doing Philly Press Box Radio, and he's always a lot of fun and gives good insight. Mark's been covering the Eagles since the mid-80s, so last year we asked him to recall some of the most memorable plays he's witnessed in that time.
Number one, the Randall Cunningham versus the Giants on Monday Night Football, when Carl Banks would have put any other quarterback maybe out with the hit he put on him. Instead, Randall just kind of like rebounds, bounced back up and threw a touchdown pass to Jimmy Giles. That's number one. Number two, again, is Randall Cunningham, but it's not even the play. It's just the whole essence of the play was the fake kneel down against the Cowboys
yep.
in the game after the strike, because that's a play you've never seen before, and unless another Buddy Ryan comes around, you'll never see it again, where the game's over, Eagles are in victory formation, first down, Randall takes a snap, takes a knee. Second down, Randall takes a snap, takes a knee. Third down, Randall takes a snap, fakes like he's going to take the knee, stands up and throws a bomb to Mike Wick, just because of the whole thing about it. That's number two. Number three is going to be tough. Let me put a defensive play in there for you. Oh, Eric Allen's interception return against the Jets at the Meadowlands, the day that Randall Cunningham broke his leg. Boomer Esiason was the quarterback. Eric Allen picks him off and brings it back. I think it was 90 yards, but he ran about 180 yards, just zigzagging all across the field. And then after he scored, Randall had just come out of the tunnel on crutches, and Eric Allen sees him and runs over and gives Randall the ball.
Another guy who's witnessed plenty of memorable plays is the radio voice of the Eagles, now entering his 40th year in that role. We asked Merrill Reese to give us a couple of his favorites.
I'm going to give you number one, and this may surprise people, because in my first year I had the original Miracle of the Meadowlands with Herman Edwards scooping up the Joe Pizarcic fumble, so that's really right up there. But my very favorite was December 19th, 2010, and that was the game at the Meadowlands against the Giants, which the Eagles, I remember saying at halftime, the score is something like the Giants 21, the Eagles are still back at the hotel. And lo and behold, Michael Vick rallied them through a long touchdown pass to Brent Celek. They recovered an onside kick. Vick marched them running, passing, did everything. Got the final touchdown when he hit Jeremy Maclin inside the left pylon. They held the Giants in defense. They forced Max Dodge to punt. And then that great walk-off equivalent of a grand slam by DeSean Jackson, who muffed the punt, picked it up, got a hellacious block from Jason Avant, took it up the middle, and danced into the end zone. That would be number one. But there were so many other great ones, like that snowy day when the Eagles beat Atlanta in that NFC Championship game. And, of course, the one with Wilbur Montgomery off the right side against the Dallas Cowboys back in January, I think it was January 10th, 1981, the one that put the Eagles in their first Super Bowl, Super Bowl 15.
Can't wait to talk to Merrill again when he joins us for show number 100. Not the only great play-by-play guy we've talked to on Philly Press Box Radio. We got a Phillies season preview in both the spring of 2015 and 2016 from none other than Tom McCarthy. T-Mac is a real pleasure to talk to, and during his first visit, we reflected on his June 2014 catch when he and his broadcast partners called the game from the center field stands at Citizens Bank Park.
Look at me.
Deep to center field, out toward our vantage point.
Tom gets home! Yes!
Not good that he hit a home run, but I was able to catch it.
That was quite a moment, Tom.
It was an unbelievable moment. I mean, you know, you never try to make anything about you as a broadcaster. It's always about the game and what's happening on the field. But that was – I've had several moments that I will never, ever forget, whether it be Princeton beating UCLA, the Carrills last year, being the coach at Princeton University, or Roy Halladay's perfect game. I mean, that was unbelievable. And when Freddie Freeman hit that ball, it just sounded like he hit it really well. And if I would have dropped it, I would have never heard the end of it for my kids. They would have exploited it over and over and over again if I had dropped that ball.
That's for sure. Who were your sports broadcasting heroes growing up in the 70s and early 80s?
Well, the biggest hero that I had, just because I listened to him all the time, was Bob Murphy. I thought he was as good a radio announcer as you will find, because he was able to sort of relate to the fan and sort of tell the story. Obviously, Vin Scully was huge. Ernie Harwell was huge. I've gotten a chance to meet all three of them, and they were unbelievable resources to talk to. And then, of course, HK. I mean, growing up in New Jersey, there was sort of a triangle of Yankees, Mets, and Phillies games that were always on in my house. And just the way Harry called the big moment, there's nobody that can call the big moment the way that he did.
When it comes to great journalists and expert analysts, there's none better than Hall of Fame sports writer Ray Dinger. Despite the fact that he's still busy as heck with his work on Comcast Sportsnet and WIP, not to mention writing the wonderfully received play Tommy and Me, Ray has managed to find time to grace us with his insight five times over the past 2 years. In one of those visits, we asked what we thought might be a tough question to name in order the three greatest Eagles of all time. Not tough at all, apparently.
Easy. Bednarik, Van Buren, Reggie White.
Wow. How would Chuck Bednarik do in today's NFL?
He'd be a star. He'd be a great player. He'd be a great player in any era, because he's one of the rare players of his era that actually had the size to play in this era. I mean, Chuck was 6'3 and 235 pounds, which would be fine size for a linebacker in today's NFL. A little bit small, I guess, for a center, but he could play linebacker at that size. And probably today he'd probably be more like 250, but he could absolutely play with his instincts and his strength and his want to. Yeah, I think if I had to rate all the players, he would be the number one, because he was the best player at two different positions for a decade. And there aren't many players in the history of the game you can say that about.
Ray Dinger and his radio partner, Glenn Mack, now a few years back, wrote an awesome book called The Ultimate Book of Sports Movies. And we asked Ray how their top two ended up being Rocky and Hoosiers.
When it came right down to it, we decided to go Rocky number one. Just such a wonderful story, and so beautifully tells the story of the underdog, which is really the template for most sports movies. And we both loved Hoosiers, and plus Gene Hackman wrote the foreword for the book, so we couldn't put him down. We couldn't put him too far down the list, so we made Hoosiers
really?
Number two.
Raging Bull coming in third on that list, by the way. Phil's reporter Leslie Goodell of Comcast Sportsnet is another one of our favorite guests. In the summer of 2015, just before the team parted ways with shortstop Jimmy Rollins, Leslie told us she agreed with Hall of Fame shortstop Barry Larkin that Rollins should join the former Reds great in Cooperstown when he's eligible.
I think that Jimmy Rollins' numbers over time and the longevity in the game certainly helps, but I think Jimmy deserves to be in the Hall of Fame when you compare him. And like Barry pointed out, he said, hey, you know, his numbers are better than mine, and I'm in the Hall of Fame. said something, and he did that with one team, and he was there to help bring the team over the hump. You know, obviously the overall numbers make a difference, but I think the whole package of what Jimmy's done in his career in Philadelphia does make him Hall of Fame worthy, absolutely.
We had also raised the question a few times on our program about whether former Sixer Allen Iverson would be a first ballot basketball Hall of Famer. But one of Leslie's co-workers at Comcast Sportsnet is longtime 76ers reporter Dee Lynam, who had told us that Iverson was absolutely deserving. And she was right. AI was voted into the Hall earlier this year and will be inducted September 9th. Speaking of Dee Lynam, she was on with us last February and lamented the fact that the 76ers family had lost a couple of legends in the previous few months, Daryl Dawkins and Moses Malone.
I didn't really know Daryl as a player. I only got to know him when he was in, you know, a role after his playing career. But yes, just an infectious personality. And the other thing, I think, you know, we talk about it after the fact, but he was ahead of his time in terms of marketing himself, coming up with names for his dunks, having such a flair. I'd love to have known what he would have made his Twitter handle if you had had Twitter back then, or what he would have tweeted about on a given day. That seems like it's right up the alley of who he would have thrived and enjoyed being as a player. And I'll say for Moses, too, I actually played in a charity poker tournament and sat next to Moses, which was like a couple of hours. That was a couple of years back. And that was probably the first time that I was with him in that kind of setting, as opposed to, you know, interviewing him or, you know, talking basketball. And a real gentle spirit as well. So I think that was a big hit for that organization. And just to lose him at such young ages.
A must-read in the Sunday Inquirer is the Frank's Place column in the sports section. We had Frank Fitzpatrick on with us a couple of times, helping us to recap the years 2014 and 15 on the Philly sports scene. Not exactly the best of times for fans around here.
I guess I've been around Philadelphia sports so long that it's difficult for me to work up a healthy optimism. Philadelphia is, we're more in our comfort zone right now. You know, when we're whining and complaining and pleading and wondering what's going to get better. When the Phillies were having that run in the, you know, 2007, 2008, 2009, it was unnatural for me. I was looking at the city and the fans, and it just didn't feel real to me, you know. Now we're back at a point where it kind of feels real. We're all wondering what the heck's going on here. There's sort of a delicious self-pity about it all.
Lo and behold, a few months later, Jay Wright's Villanova Wildcats brought some much-needed joy to Philly sports fans, winning the men's NCAA basketball championship on a buzzer-beating three-pointer by Chris Jenkins. We brought Frank back on the show two nights later to talk about that dramatic Nova victory over North Carolina and how it compared to Raleigh Massimino's upset win back in 1985.
It was just a great game. It was one of the best college games of any kind. Forget about playoffs. It's one of the best college games of any kind I've seen.
Well, Frank, I have to ask you, since you wrote the book, literally, The Perfect Game, about the 1985 team upset in Georgetown, and you know, that was a David and Goliath type thing, and I don't think you're writing a book about this one, but maybe you are. But how do you compare that game to this game?
Well, you know, Nova being a two seed, you know, and being ranked number one during the course of the season, it sort of takes away from that David and Goliath aspect a little. I don't think the disparity between the two teams was nearly as marked as it was in that Georgetown-Villanova game from 85. Both games, I think, were highlighted by the opening tap to final whistle intensity. I mean, I just found it astounding how Villanova could maintain that level of defense for the whole tournament, really, but for 40 minutes of that game, they just were relentless. In terms of being an entertaining game, I would take this game only because of the way it ended. The 85 game, you know, there wasn't a shot clock, there wasn't a three-point shot, so Villanova took a little more time on its possessions. So that was a little less entertaining than the pace of this game. But, you know, they were two great, two classic games. I don't think this game ranks in terms of its historical significance. That Georgetown-Villanova game is still probably the greatest upset in the history of the NCAA championship game, whereas this game might be the most entertaining game in championship history, but it wasn't the greatest upset.
Basketball Jones! I got a basketball Jones!
Speaking of classic college basketball, who could forget John Wooden's UCLA Bruins dynasty in the late 1960s and early 70s? Well, our most listened-to program to date was last March when we were joined by one of Coach Wooden's star players from back in the day, Andre McCarter. The former Overbrook High star, a great point guard, told Bill about the need to tone down his Philly swagger in playing for that legendary coach.
I had to adjust to the way he liked the game more basically played. I already had a high level, in my opinion, of not turning the ball over, playing team ball. So it wasn't any kind of disciplinary problems that we had. It was just a matter of flair in the way I, you know, in Philadelphia, we like to entertain the crowd while still being able to get the job done. But Coach Wooden wanted to just get the job done instead of going behind the back, do all these other things. And so what he did in a way is raise my proficient level even up higher to see the game on another plateau that allowed me to go literally without turnovers and mistakes.
I read a story where you were in practice and you came down and you did a little fake behind the back pass one way and faked, and I believe it was Bill Walton actually, you faked him out and you shoveled it the other way, and it was a very pretty play, and everybody thought so except for Coach. And he took you into the office and he gave you analytical breakdown of why that was not a good play. Is that a true story?
In essence, yeah, it was like that. Basically, Bill was one of the greatest players as far as the ability to block shots and things of that nature. So it was fun, you know, for me with all the stuff that used to play in the playgrounds in Philly, you know, trick basketball. We've seen Earl Monroe, Guy Rogers, you know, you got so many examples of guys that knew how to do stuff with the ball. So I did one of those on him, and, you know, all the players just fell out laughing. I mean, then he went one way thinking the ball went that way and went the other way. In the meantime, here comes Coach Wooden, and you could kind of hear him fast walking down the court. Andre, grace and sakes alive, you know, and he's going off and all this stuff. You know, you do that kind of play and walk here and this and that and the other. And so the next day I go in the office because I want to know the play was successful. I want to know what's going on. So I get in, he finally calms me down. We get to talking. He says, well, let me show you some statistics. So he goes in his drawer. I knew I was in trouble when it happened. And he starts pulling out these cards where he has kept track of statistical information on whether you throw in this particular situation this kind of pass or if you throw the basic two-hand pass on this situation, what the percentage was. Make a long story short, by the time he finished with the information, the pass I make was successful about 78% of the time. The pass he was talking about I could have made in that situation and still made the play was like 98%. So you're sitting there and you're like, well, which one are you going to choose? I couldn't go for the 78 even though I loved the play. I had to go with the 98. And that kind of soothed, you know, all the steam kind of just subsided. And I said, okay, Coach, I see what you're talking about.
With Villanova winning the second national title, the 76ers poised to put Joel Embiid, Ben Simmons, and Dario Saric on the court together this fall, the Flyers returning to the playoffs last spring, and the Philadelphia Soul winning Arena Bowl 29, maybe, just maybe, the Philly sports scene is about to get a whole lot better. Now, the Phillies aren't going to the postseason this year, but with top prospects like Nick Williams, J.P. Crawford, and Jorge Alfaro just about ready for the majors, it might not be a long wait, as Bucks County Courier-Times reporter Kevin Cooney told us last spring.
If they all pan out, I wouldn't be surprised if you saw a wild card push in 17. They really value these minor leaguers coming up, and they think that those minor leaguers are ahead of the game here. And if that's the case, then 2017 is a year I think you can start to see significant progress, though. I think they'll get to the finish line, probably not. But 17 is probably when you'll see the first little glimpse of contention. 18 is probably when you can expect them to make a full leap forward.
We shall see. You never know how a young player might respond to the pressure of playing in the brightest of lights. Phil's pitcher Vince Velasquez looked like an all-star in April and May, but has now gone 8 starts without earning a W. Jake Thompson looked like a can't-miss right-hander at AAA, but he's struggled mightily with his control since being called up to the Phils in early August. Could it be nerves? A Philly Press Box radio guest last spring, sports psychologist Joel Fish, had lots to say about athletes dealing with nerves.
People will come to me and say, for example, I choke or I can't handle pressure. And when you boil it down, most of us can handle pressure, but there are certain specific situations that we are still learning. I take a learning approach, how to handle it better. So maybe it was learning to let go of that first mistake. Let it go, focus on the moment, next play. Because a lot of times, if you look at baseball, you know, it's or almost any sport, it's the frustration that comes along with making a mistake or not having the ability to let go of a mistake that we take to the next play, and it just compounds itself. So for a baseball player, it might be, okay, what are you going to say? What are you going to do after that first error? For a pitcher, how do you relax yourself when you walk somebody? For the tennis player, okay, we know match point creates a lot of tension. let's come up with a game plan, things you can say or do in match point situations. So when you're in that situation, you can say, I know I'm feeling a little anxious, but I know what to do. And whenever you have a plan, I think you're going to be more in control. Whenever you're more in control, you're going to feel more relaxed and more confident. If you're more confident, your natural talent's going to flow. So that's a long-winded way of saying, I think you can break down choking, pressure performance to specific game situations. And I find when you do that, it's much more manageable for athletes. It makes it just much more of a manageable part of the learning curve.
One guy whom all Eagles fans will be watching closely over the next several years is Carson Wentz. A week before, the North Dakota State signal caller was even taken by the Birds with the second overall pick in the 2016 draft. Draft guru Fran Duffy made his annual pre-draft visit to Philly Press Box Radio and said the likely Eagles quarterback of the future looks to have a pretty big upside.
You see the physical tools, and they're certainly there. He's almost 240 pounds. He's a big kid. He's a good athlete. He's got a good arm. He's accurate, good decision maker. And really, honestly, the big thing that's always stood out to me with Carson Wentz are the mental traits. You know, and he had full autonomy at the line of scrimmage. He was given everything pre-snap in terms of what the play call was going to be. He set all the protections all year long for North Dakota State when he was in the game. There was a play, guys, against Weber State. It was in September. They were on the 25-yard line. Weber State comes out. They show a blitz from the right side. He goes to the line of scrimmage. Wentz does, changes the play up, calls a quarterback run to the left. He runs 26 yards for a touchdown. And that's the kind of thing, the pre-snap ability to be able to see, okay, this is what the defense is doing. How can I best put my offense in position to move the football down the field? He did that repeatedly. That was just one instance, but did that a number of different times for North Dakota State. And my good friend Greg Cosell from NFL Films obviously has been doing this for a long, long time. And Greg will tell me, look, it doesn't matter where you do it. It doesn't matter who you do it against. It's how you do it. What exactly, and by that, I mean, he played at North Dakota State, sure. But we see players come from small schools every single year in the draft and thrive in the NFL, even early as rookies. If you have talent, the NFL is going to find you, and they're going to leverage you to the best of your ability.
There are still some doubters out there, and Bleeding Green Nation's Brandon Lee Gowton told us just how important it is for Howie Roseman to have been right about the decision to trade up via two separate deals to get to number 2 overall to take Wentz.
This is the move that really either makes or breaks the franchise. It really makes or breaks his tenure here, you know. If the quarterback risk pays off, you have a franchise quarterback. The Eagles haven't had one of those since Donovan McNabb. If it doesn't,
you got it.
I think it's a position where they know they need to move on from Howie Roseman and Doug Peterson and everyone else involved.
Bill and I have enjoyed every single one of our guests, honestly, but I think we get extra excited on those occasions that we have former pro athletes on with us. We know we'll always get some great stories and some great insight from those guys who play the game. Remember how so many of us, as fans, questioned the coaching ability of Eagles head man Rich Cotite back in the early 90s? Well, his former wide receiver, Fred Barnett, isn't going to try to change our minds. Check this out.
Rich was not a head coach. He was a position coach, and he knows it, and he should have been a head coach.
Here's another question I had for Arkansas Fred during his August 2014 visit.
How would Fred Barnett do in a Chip Kelly-type offense?
I would be probably the highest paid player in the world. I would be bragging every week.
We've got to get Fred Barnett back on the show. Former Phillies pitcher Larry Christensen, a member of the 1980 World Championship team, told us last winter about playing with Pete Rose, as well as playing for oft-criticized manager Danny Ozark. LC and Ozark both arrived in Philly in 1973.
You know, it's very similar to the way people felt about Charlie Manuel starting out with the Phillies, you know, and they didn't accept him. Danny was a player's manager. He was a great guy. He came out of the Dodger organization, and I think there's proof in the pudding right there. But Danny was a really nice man. Danny let us play, and it was too bad that Danny ended up getting moved out, you know, when it started to really gel, and then we ended up winning a World Series in 1980.
Larry, I wanted to ask you about those teams. You know, you played on some really, really good teams. And as we said, you guys all grew up together with Boa and Schmidt and Lozinski and Maddox and Boone and all that. But then came along Pete Rose. And I wanted to ask you, as a player on that team and coming up through the great teams that couldn't get over the hump, does Pete Rose deserve as much credit from the player standpoint as he's given from the fan standpoint?
Pete Rose was definitely the guy that was the spark plug for the 1980 team. And if he was not on that team, I'm very doubtful that we may have gone as far as we did, because I don't think our team was as good in 80 as it was in 76, 7, and 8, those teams there. But my gosh, when we got him in the winter of free agency in 78, it was, because he was with us in 79. But Pete was a guy that he helped Mike Schmidt become a better player. I think everybody played a lot harder because Pete always was in the cage taking batting practice. All, you know, came from the Big Red Machine. Getting him in the first place was a real gift. But I'm still great friends with Pete, very supportive of Pete. He did make a mistake. He should be in the Hall of Fame. He always said, I'm going to be a unanimous Hall of Famer, and obviously that did not happen and may not happen.
More recently, we had a terrific time talking with former Eagle Bill Bradley. The Palestine, Texas native still today holds, with Brian Dawkins and Eric Allen, a share of the Eagles' all-time interceptions record, 34. But you know, you never forget your first one. For Bill Bradley, it came late in his 1969 rookie season.
The first interception was, we were playing the Cowboys, and Gummy Carr was our DV coach, so they were giving us the business. And so about the middle to the end of the third quarter, I asked Coach Carr if I could go in. I said, won't you let some of us young guys play, and this game's out of hand, and then that way you won't get your veterans hurt, and you can see what we can do. Well, he just said, get away, I'm coaching right now. It was 40-something to 17 or something like that. And about the middle of the fourth, I went up to him and he'd had enough. He said, well, just get in there then. Well, the first play, we were blitzing the Cowboys back then, and the adjustments were to hit quick look-ins or slants or just quick passes when we're bringing everybody. So my job was to come over from the free safety and cover the tight end because the strong safety was blitzing off the edge. So Staubach had just come back from the Navy and they put him in, and they had just gotten a new tight end from Chicago, which was Ditka. And so they missed the check. Ditka saw me coming over to get him, and he straightened up his route. Well, Roger threw to the quick look in and hit me right in the hands. I took it, went down the near sideline and got a good block or two and took it into the end zone. And that was my first play from the line of scrimmage in the National Football League, was an interception with a 54-yard touchdown.
Don't cheat yourself, Super Bill. It was actually a 56-yard touchdown return. Talk about fun. The show last January, when we had former Eagle Dennis Franks on the program. And then we got a call from Denny's old special teams buddy from the 1976 through 78 Eagles, Vince Papale. They told us just how much fun they had playing special teams for Dick Vermeil.
We knew what our role was. We were bomb spotters at Dennis. I mean, one of the most important positions as a long snapper. I mean, you sort of take that snap for granted, but you don't want to be the guy that's making the snap. And, you know, and then coming down in coverage, and we used to compete against each other about trying to get down there first to make the hit. And the night before, then remember the night before, we'd be watching on the games. We'd be sitting there just sort of saying, okay, what do you want to do on the first play? We're trying to figure out what would be the craziest thing we could possibly do on the opening kickoff or the kickoff return. And we wound up doing it.
Yeah. We used to go down screaming loud and crazy, you know, and it was like amazing. We'd make contacts. You know, Vince was a little bit more fleeted, and he was always a step and a half or two ahead of me. But it's sort of like
a step and a half or two.
Hey, wait a minute. Don't be coming down on our lineman now. Give him credit for running. We'd have some great competitions and big hits. Big hits.
You know Barrett Brooks these days from Breakfast on Broad on TV, but the former Eagle, Lion, and Steeler was a pretty good offensive lineman back in the late 1990s and early 2000s. He caught us by surprise when we asked him who the toughest defensive lineman was to try to block, especially since the legend that he named was very late in his Hall of Fame career when Barrett went up against him.
Oh, everybody calls him Reggie or Reggie White. I call him Mr. White. He was by far, God rest his soul, the hardest guy to block ever. You know, he was the best to ever play the game. In fact, they always say that Rice is the best player to ever play. No, it'd have to be Mr. White. He is the best player to ever play football.
Talk about high praise for the Minister of Defense. Other experts to visit Philly Press Box Radio included Mike Reichenbach, Kevin Riley, and Gary Cobb. Yet another memorable guest and all-around fun guy was former Philly Glenn Wilson. Now, Glenn Bell spent only 4 seasons in Philadelphia, but he told us it was absolutely his favorite place over his 11-year Major League career.
To me, Philadelphia is my baseball home. When I go out in public, you know, I still wear baseball caps. I wear a Phillies hat. I wear a Phillies jersey, T-shirts. I still wear Philly stuff. My office is decorated with all my Philly stuff, and I've got a portion of Detroit, Sam Houston, and Houston. But, man, Philadelphia is what made Glenn Wilson a better baseball player.
Hey, if you're in your 50s or 60s or older, you probably remember how incredibly popular roller derby once was. Seriously, for a lot of folks, including yours truly, watching roller games, the Philadelphia Warriors or Eastern Warriors, was a Sunday night ritual in the late 1960s and early 70s. So it was a real thrill to have the great Judy Arnold visit Philly Press Box Radio in July to reminisce about those days.
I can't tell you how many people over the years that I've spoken to said that was a family time for my family. We didn't sit down and do anything together, but we'd sit and watch roller games together. And it brought our family together. Or I came with my grandma, and my grandma loved you. And, you know, I just hear all that stuff of how families were together watching roller games. So that's really pretty neat for me.
Hockey's pretty darn popular in Philadelphia too, of course, and we had a super time talking with former Flyers great Brian Propp in August of 2015. As we do with many of our guests, we put Brian in the hot seat during his visit, peppering him with a bunch of questions. Here's a bit of that segment with Propper.
Who was the best fighter in the league in your era?
Ben Wilson by far.
Wow, one of your teammates. All right, now put your thinking cap on for this one. You're putting together the Flyers' all-time team. Fred Sherrill's the coach. Bernie's in goal. Clarkie's the center. Who are the two wingers and the two defensemen?
Well, can I put Eric Lindros on one wing?
Sure.
And I put Mark Recchi on the left wing, and then I'd use Mark Howe and Eric Desjardins.
All right, yeah, a lot of great candidates on the forward line, that's for sure. And finally, hockey players seem to love nicknames, from true nicknames like the Hammer, Moose, the Count, or Bundy, to variations on players' names, like Clarkie, Hexie, or Propper. What player nicknames stick out in your mind as among the best?
Well, if you look at the Rat, I mean, that was pretty pretty close to what he was like. And actually, my good friend Brad McCrimmon, we called him the Beast, you know, so like there was a couple things that you could put into that too.
And just one quick follow-up. Is it true that teammates called Bill Barber Arnie because he reminded them of Arnold the Pig of Green Acres fame?
Yes, but, you know, Billy's awesome. He's just a fabulous guy.
Now, this guy didn't play the game, but he was on the field at Veterans Stadium for 15 or 16 years. His name is David Raymond, the original Philly fanatic. He visited Philly Press Box Radio last year and talked about how much he loved his job and having fun with players, Phillies, and their opponents.
The Mets were my favorite team to interact with because they were full of a bunch of, you know, cut-ups and Jay Johnstone-type players. They were just coming into their own as they moved into the middle 80s, so they were having some success, and Hubie Brooks loved to fool around with the Fanatic, and my fond memory of him was performing at a spring training game down in Clearwater. And he had set up for the whole Mets to come running out of the dugout in mass and tackle me and jump on me, which they did. And Hubie had always been playing around with the Fanatic prior to that during the season. So they all came to me, but I fell on my back and they were stacked on top of me. And I started to get claustrophobic and nervous that I was going to get hurt. So Hubie was the first one that had jumped on me. So he was laying on top of me and I started screaming at him, "Hubie, get off. You guys are hurting me." And then at the same time, I reached down to the inside of his thigh, and I started pinching the inside of his thigh as hard as I could. And he started screaming, "Get off, he's serious, get off." And they all jumped off, and he came in to see me because he heard that the Fanatic had broken his nose. He thought that I had broken my nose, but when they jumped on me, it had actually snapped the costume's nose. And so I said, "No, you dummy, you didn't break my nose, you broke the Fanatic's nose." And then he pulls up his shorts and shows me the giant hickey that I had made on the inside of his thigh by squeezing his skin. He goes, "Yeah, but you injured me." So it was those types of relationships that I just really treasured, because it meant that whenever those guys came into town, they knew me as a person and they really loved the Fanatics. So they would get together and play all kinds of practical jokes that ended up being wonderful entertainment you know, that I didn't even, you know, create. It was just the player's love of the Fanatic and having fun. It was those types of memories, and there's dozens and dozens and dozens of them with people like Willie Stargell and Dave Parker, you know, the greats and Hall of Famers that I got to know and got to meet and interact with. That really is the real joy of being the Fanatic. And the thing that I miss today is the Philadelphia fans and the players and getting to know the personal side of some of these players.
Another one of our guests knows all about the popularity of the Philly Fanatic. He's Philly's Director of Fun and Games, John Brazier.
How is it that the Philly Fanatic has remained so beloved by fans for 38 years?
Well, he's the best, and especially when you think about it, we unveiled a mascot in 1978 in Philadelphia, of all cities. You know, I know San Diego had the chicken, but that was the radio station chicken. That wasn't the Padres chicken. So I think it's got to be a fun character, a cool character, and it's a character that basically is like a perpetual 8-year-old. It doesn't take itself too seriously. And I'm telling you, as a fan, I grew up watching the Fanatic, and for the last 23 years at work, I see the Fanatic all the time. And I'm telling you, it is funny every time. Sometimes when he does the streak, I don't know if you ever see him do the streak, he'll do it once a year where we'll play that song, The Streak, by Ray Stevens, and he'll come out of the right field gate tunnel without a jersey on, and he's just all green, and he's running around like he's streaking. Absolutely hysterical. If you're ever watching pregame Dan Baker do the lineups, you'll see the Fanatic basically imitating every one of our players, sometimes the other players as well. So it never gets old, and it's rare in this town that something can last that long and be so beloved.
Speaking of the Fanatic, does he still have an odor problem sometime in the summer?
Yes. As I've said before, he smells like a petting zoo located on Low Tide Island. I had to drive down to Clearwater with the Fanatic, and I tell you what, it was basically like a damp shag rug driving down to Florida. You know, it took 2 days to get down there, and man, I had Fanatic flu after I got out of that car in Florida.
Hey, if our little internet radio show can stick around one quarter as long as the Fanatic has, we'll consider it to be a big success. 99 shows down, number 100 coming up, and many, many more ahead, we hope. Thank you to our dozens of amazing guests, those you heard in this highlight show, and the many others who've also taken their time to visit us over the past 2.25 years. And special thanks to our core listeners. You know who you are. We do this for you and others like you who love Philly sports. Thanks also to Bob Sullivan at ChopForKisses.org, marketing maven Mary Flanagan, substitute hosts Steve Switkowitz and Fred Hugo, and of course, Carl Henderson at Carl's Cards and Collectibles. We appreciate each and every one of you.
Well, Chad, I have to tell you, that was just absolutely fantastic. Great work, and I know you worked really hard on it, and the result was just excellent.
Thanks, Bill. Yeah, it was a lot of hours involved in that, but it was certainly a lot of fun listening to all those clips. I mean, I could have included a whole bunch more because we had a lot of other guests that I couldn't squeeze in, unfortunately, or just forgot to add in the final version, but boy, we had some good guests over the last 2.25 years. I got to tell you, I don't know how we did it, but I love our guests.
Oh, me too. Me too. And as you said, they're all good, and they all like to come on and talk and tell stories. And it's there's never a dull moment with any of them. And you know what? The next 100 or next 98, hopefully, are going to be every bit as good as this 98.
I'm sure. Was I right? Don't you love the old ball players talking about the old days? That's my favorite thing too.
Oh, me too. Me too. And we've had a bunch of those guys. And I think the older they get, the better the stories get with Bill Bradley and Larry Christensen and Glenn Wilson and those guys. Great stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I can't wait to have more of those guys on with us.
All right. So, hey, what do we have in store for show number 100 next Wednesday, September 7th?
Well, we've got Merrill Reese coming back on with us. He was just announced that he's going into the Eagles Hall of Fame this November. And, of course, he's starting up his 40th year with the Bird. So it's going to be great to hear from Merrill again. And a first-time guest, one of my favorite Eagles from back in the late 80s and early 90s, Seth Joyner, making his first appearance on Philly Press Box Radio.
Oh, can't wait. A great way to celebrate number 100. And I know we've got some guests we're working on to follow up, to fill up the football season, and it's going to be a blast.
And by the way, D. Lynam is going to stop by too next week for a little cameo appearance because she's going to be going up to Springfield, Massachusetts for AI getting inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame, and she's going to give us a brief phone interview about that a couple of days ahead of time.
Oh, that'd be great. And also we'll be unveiling our what do we call it, Fred and Butter. our little Fred and Butter segment we're going to have for this football season. We'll be rolling that out with Fred Hugo next week as well.
Oh, that's right. Yes, it is almost football season. In fact, it starts a week from tomorrow night. So, boy, I'm ready. I don't know about you, but I'm ready for football.
I am ready, too. All right. Well, Chad, I think we are at the top of the hour. It went by quick. Great job. And so let's go ahead again. We'll thank our guest, Carl Henderson, Carl's Cards and Collectibles, for their continuing support of the show. Mary Flanagan, our marketing extraordinaire behind the scenes, and our sponsor, shopforkisses.org, the online shopping network of the Kisses for Kyle Foundation. For Jim Chachesco, this is Bill Furman. We hope you enjoyed show number 99, and we'll join Philly Press Box Radio on Wednesday, September 7th at 7 p.m. as we celebrate show number 100 with guests legendary Merle Reese and former Eagle Pro Bowler Seth Joyner. You can listen through our Facebook page or on the internet at www.blogtalkradio.com/Philly Press Box Radio and on both iTunes and Stitcher. High hopes, Philadelphia sports fans.
E-S-E-C-T.